Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a busy week for August. Karl Rove, the earth in Utah, and the markets all in motion. A resigning Rove choked up at the president's side.
And I'm grateful to have been a witness to history. It has been the joy and the honor of a lifetime.
In Utah, three mine rescuers now dead. Governor John Huntsman asked for prayer and more prayer.
We've asked already people in this state and in this country and throughout the world, in fact, to offer prayers.
And global investors stared at the drama of the Dow.
Analysts say investors are unloading risky shares, panicked by the troubled U.S. mortgage markets. Some even characterize the mood as super pessimistic and say there's no end in sight to the panic.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. Joining us today from Des Moines, Iowa, is Ann Kornblut, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. She's been following Karl Rove's departure and would-be successors to George Bush this week. Ann, good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome. Thank you.
And with us from Culver City, California, Roy Seacoff, founding editor of The Huffington Post, the online news website with its eye on the world. Roy, good to have you back as well. Thanks for being here today.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Ann, and Roy.
So much going on. I barely know where to dive in, except I guess people with some cash in there must be absolutely obsessed with what's going on in the markets this week. Roy, I mean, in the United States, around the world, Asia, you know, rocking on these markets. The Fed now stepping in to drop a rate down a little bit and maybe bring some peace to this situation. What do you make of it?
Tom, I'm thankful that I'm not in the market right now. just looking at my mortgage and thinking, well, maybe it's the time to make a move.
But boy, everybody who's in there has really got eyes wide open. Ann Kornblut, it seemed as though Ben Bernanke didn't want to come in and do anything here. He wanted people to kind of pay the piper for the hyper-aggressive, you know, lending and mortgages and all the rest. Has he folded here a little bit?
It would look that way, certainly. He had said earlier this was going to be, you know, this is what you get when you ride the markets. These kinds of ups and downs. What I found interesting being out here in Des Moines, as you said, and on the campaign trail this week, is that increasingly the candidates are starting to get a question about this. Yesterday at the Iowa State Fair, of all places, John Edwards got a question about the markets and what would he do. And the candidates are really capitalizing on it as a measure of the instability of the Bush years. And the fact that it's all these corporations who've made so much money and regular people who are trying to get by, invest, have not. So its tentacles are spreading even beyond just people's own pocketbooks.
Instability of the Bush years, maybe, Jack. Well, on the other hand, the market's been up and up and up in those years. But we're reminded with the big wobble how, you know, Social Security not doing so great and millions of Americans depending on that market to deliver some kind of retirement and college and whatever someday.
Yes, and I think one piece of political fallout from this crisis is on the front page of the Wall Street Journal today. A story about John Edwards. It turns out that he had $16 million invested in one of these subprime lenders that was foreclosing, that has brought foreclosure suits against victims of Hurricane Katrina, including people in the Ninth Ward, where when he announced his candidacy in April
in New Orleans.
He decried what he called shameful lending practices. He talked about when Washington turns a blind eye, irresponsible lenders are pulling a fast one on hard-earned. He got $500,000 in 2006 for part-time work for one of these for this firm. They are the largest political givers to his campaign. It goes on and on. And one woman who has been foreclosed down there, lives in a Mrs. Commodore lives in a trailer now. When she was told about Edward's connection to the company that had seized her house, she said, quote, "Why would he pick on poor people? Why indeed?" I don't know that his candidacy is going to survive this revelation.
But he's been the champion of the poor and the downtrodden, yet he's a guy with money, and a whole lot of money is attached to mortgages at this point. We'll keep an eye on those markets, and we're really interested to hear what listeners have to say about them. But there's so much going on this week, it just doesn't feel like an August tempo. Roy, across that big sort of boiling sea of developments, what are you looking at? What's really got your attention this week?
Well, obviously the top story this week has to be the exit of the boy genius, Karl Rove. And I thought it was kind of interesting the way he went out. He went out the way he had helped forge the administration. I found his exit fairly delusional, fanatical, and downright deceptive.
The Huffington Post speaks. What do you mean, delusional, deceptive, and all the rest?
Well, start with the fanaticism. Just like his boss, George Bush, remember when they asked Bush to name one mistake he had made and he couldn't? He was like, you caught me with my pants down. I can't think of one. Well, here was Karl Rove, and in the very friendly environs of the Wall Street Journal, and they asked him, well, what mistakes would you say you had made in the White House? And he said, well, I'll have to wait till I'm back in Texas and put my feet up on the desk and think about that one. And I found that it was kind of amazing with, all the mistakes floating right out there, Iraq going down the tubes, Afghanistan not going well, bungling it with Katrina. He couldn't think of one mistake. So that was the typical.
Yeah, we hear that. And what about it? Is it going to be feet up on the desk in Texas? I mean, already from Texas, he's been throwing some little thunderbolts this week, Hillary Clinton's way in particular. Is Karl Rove really out to pasture or something else down there?
It's hard to imagine Karl Rove just checking out and going to clear brush the way Bush does at the ranch. I would expect him to take a little time off to perhaps write a book, go on speaking tour, make some money. And then I would expect him also to be weighing in pretty regularly in this presidential campaign. He has a lot of opinions. He knows a lot. And conservatives, despite all the mistakes, and in addition to the ones that were just listed, I would say the political mistakes that were made under Karl Rove, in particular the 2006 midterms, which he was determined he was going to win before they took place, I would say that despite all that, his voice will still be really respected one in the country among conservatives. And so we will continue to hear from him as he gets down there and possibly even hear him giving advice to some of the candidates.
He may be on microphones. He may be on the phone with the president. I don't know. But he won't be right down the hall. What about the White House post-Rove? How's it look, Ann?
It's a very different place. It's true that the president isn't himself running for re-election for anything now, so he doesn't need his top political advisor right there, perhaps at his side, making every decision. But he really ran a lot more than just the politics. He ran the politics of the grassroots. He kept the president in touch with what everyone was thinking around the country, down to the state legislature level. So, and in a White House where we've already seen some very prominent departures, Dan Bartlett, of course, going, Megan O'Sullivan, who had been the Iraq point person, and a couple of new people in, relatively new, Tony Snow, Ed Gillespie. It's really sort of down to the bare bones at this point on the way out.
Roy, so what's it going to be in the White House in this last, the last months? Is it, the president alone and looking out? Is it about Iran? Of course, interesting crank up there on that front this week with the elite Iranian troops described maybe soon as a terrorist organization by the U.S. government. Or is it going to be, wedding bells and white satin with Jenna announcing her engagement to be married?
No, I don't think that'll be the key. I think there's going to be two things. One, it'll be running out the clock, trying to avoid all the investigations on Gonzalez and Harriet Myers and Rove himself. I think it'll be just trying to stall, the stall tactics. But on the other hand, the interesting thing that you said is happening. It's the battle within the White House. On one side, you have Gates and Condoleezza Rice. On the other side, you have Dick Cheney. And they're pushing and pushing on this Iran issue. And that's what this is all about. It's trying to be as provocative as possible, putting the Revolutionary Guard on the terror list, a terrorist organization. And I think if Cheney has his way, we might be seeing some bombs falling there in Iran.
Let's listen to State Department spokesman Sean McCormick talking this week about the dangers that he said Iran continues to present in the world. Speaking, as news reports said, the U.S. was preparing to label the elite Republican Guard as terrorists.
They now have tentacles into all sorts of different activities, into business activities, into banking activities. We all know about their support for those groups that are going after our troops in Iraq. There have also been numerous news reports about their linkages with Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations.
Jack Beatty, sort of cranking down the Bush White House operation or cranking up for some dust-up with Iran?
Well, producing an incoherent policy, it seems to me. I mean, on the one hand, they want to be serious with Iran about dealing with the issues within within Iraq to stabilize the country at minimum, to get their help in doing that. And on the other hand, they're thinking about calling part of its army a terrorist organization. Now, how do you get them? How do you get to negotiate with them over Iraq if on Wednesday you're calling them their army a terrorist organization?
Yeah, but I mean, what if just the explosives in Iraq are from Iran? And what if the Republican Guard does have a hand in that? It's not exactly, a cakewalk over there for U.S. troops.
No, but we need that country's support, and we need to work with them to stabilize the situation. That's their neighborhood, and we just can't pretend that they have no interest there, or that they're not supporting whoever they wish on the Shiite side. We need their help. And we have similar interests in that. We want stability there. They don't want chaos. But this kind of thing with sticking them in the eye with the stick and then saying, well, let's cooperate on security. It just seems to me to be an incoherent policy.
Yeah, and Jack, I think. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I just thought that was the most interesting quote of the day, of the week, is that they are saying that they're destabilizing Afghanistan, they're helping the Taliban, but then when they asked Karzai, he said, Iran are our brothers. So that's we're not really getting the message of what's happening over there again.
Let's take a call from Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. What do you see?
Good. I just wanted to expand on that designation of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as a specially designated global terrorist group.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think has gone underreported in all this is that that language didn't just come out of thin air. That language comes out of the joint resolution authorizing the use of force against Iraq. And the significance of this that I think needs to be reported more widely is that this is the administration's effort to lay the groundwork for launching military action against Iran or Iranian interest and without going to Congress for further authorization. So this is just the foundation move. And I'm afraid that Congress and the American people may wake up in a few weeks or months to find that we are embroiled in yet another military campaign against Iran, and the administration will claim that there is no need for Congress to authorize it. It already did so when it authorized the war against Iraq.
Let's take it to Ann Kornblut. Ann, what about it? A foundation move for something bigger here? How do you read the balance of interests in the White House, and for that matter, sort of political temperature of the country and its readiness to go down that path?
Well, I would say that certainly there's a lot of concern out in the country that I've heard so far that this is not simply a negotiating point, that it really is laying the groundwork for war in the way that groundwork had been laid back before the original Iraqi resolution. There is, at least from the circles I've been moving in, and I've now gone from following Bush last weekend in Kennebunkport to coming out here to Iowa for the duration of this week, and everywhere I've been, including near the president's parents' home in Kennebunkport, the anti-war movement in Iraq is still very much alive. People at the state fair, even though they're out enjoying themselves eating popcorn, come up to the candidates and ask them to end the war. So it's safe to say I've seen no one lobbying for another military action. A lot of the military families out here in the Midwest feeling tremendous strain already for what they've gone through. So even though at the global strategic level there's an argument to be made about what's happening, the Iranian influence that's happening in Iraq, there's certainly not that kind of clamor here on the ground.
We're looking this hour at a week in the news with Rove out, markets quaking, a mine rescue down, and much more. Ann Kornblut of the Washington Post joins us from Des Moines, Iowa today. Roy Seacoff is here from Culver City, California. He is founding editor of the Huffington Post there. Jack Beatty's here. What about that verdict on Jose Padilla? Bad guy? Fall guy? Both? Let's listen to a little tape. Here's Craig Morford, acting deputy attorney general, saying in a news conference after the Padilla verdict that the conviction sends a message.
And our duty, frankly, is to make sure that we do the things that are going to protect the people of both this country and the world from people whose sole desire in life is to obtain training to go out and commit acts of murder and mayhems. And we've got a great result here that we can stand behind, and you know, America is better off today.
They dropped the dirty bomb charges, of course. He's guilty. A jury found him guilty in pretty short order, though, of terrorism conspiracy charges on Thursday. Here's Jose Padilla's mother, Estella LeBron, saying her son would appeal his conviction. She said President Bush detained Jose unlawfully, and Padilla did not have connections to foreign terrorist groups.
American citizen locked up for 5 years with no charges. They placed some charges and some evidence. Never been in Kosovo, Bosnia, Chechnya, none of those countries. Why did he have my son in there?
Roy Seacoff, yeah. Take us to this Padilla front, if you will. It's another end of the National Security Boardwalk, and there he is, convicted. No sentencing yet. That will come soon. He spent a long time without charges in solitary confinement, an American citizen. But the jury was, you know, pretty brisk in saying, yep, he's guilty.
Well, I think the interesting thing that this shows is that the federal court system can handle terrorism cases. We don't have to be sending them down to Guantanamo and using these special military tribunals. I mean, the process worked here. As you say, it didn't have anything to do with the original claim that he was going to be the dirty bomber. But I also thought it was fairly interesting that they convicted them based on conversations in which they spoke in code, where zucchini meant something horrible.
Are we scared now?
Yes, I'm saying. You know, what else does zucchini? Every time I look at the menu now, I'm getting a little nervous.
Well, yeah, and you know, this is nothing to be proud of. This man was held for 3.5 years in isolation, a U.S. citizen without charge, and he was systematically softened up, as they say, to talk. And you know, one psychiatrist said it's clear that the intent of this isolation was to break Padilla for the purpose of the interrogations that were to follow, to break him. That's what we were doing down there. That's torture. And you know, to have the administration be proud of this, or anybody to look at this unconstitutional end run around the law that they performed, putting them there, and then to look at the processes by which they got whatever they got out of him. I mean, it's a shameful moment for American
law. Still, Anne, it's interesting. This week we had the report, from the Justice Department saying they saw the major current terrorism threat from groups within the United States, not necessarily even affiliated with al-Qaeda or foreign terrorists, sort of deciding themselves that they were angry and wanted to do something.
It's really remarkable, the number of threats that remain out there. It's just incredible.
Let's take a call from Michael in Ashford, Connecticut. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I haven't heard anything in the commentary recently putting together Rove and the upcoming Iraq report, which I think will be a turning point for our involvement in the war. And I saw Karl Rove as really instrumental in the rush to war. I think that he was really looking to Bush's reelection, and that's why they were in such a hurry to make the invasion happen. And I think that his departure now, with that judgment from Petraeus hanging over everyone's heads, I think that's telling us something. That's a leading indicator of perhaps a turn for the better if you're anti-war, but perhaps it's a collapsing of the Bush policy on Iraq.
Maybe, but so, and maybe not. And let's look at that. The September report that's been expected and kind of, you know, ballyhooed for a long time now. A dust up this week in Washington over who's going to deliver it, who's going to write it, how we're going to hear about it.
The September report has been elevated now to sort of mythic proportions. And I think what you're saying from the White House is an attempt to try and lower or at least manage expectations about what it will contain. And already predictions from some Democrats that it will simply call for kicking the can down the road a little bit more. I think the caller's point is an interesting one. My reporting over time has always suggested that Rove, although he certainly managed the politics of the Iraq War and how it played out during the elections, both in 2004 and 2006, and even to an extent in 2002. He was not involved in policy. He certainly was not on the order of Vice President Cheney or the Cheney operation in trying to advance the substance of it. But, you know, he did play a significant role in in the politics of it. I'm not sure I would read too much into the timing of his departure now. We'd been hearing that he wanted to leave for almost a year. It's an exhausting job. And in his, excuse me, his particular case, I do know that his family has been asking him to slow down for some time. So it may not be, there may not be any grand conspiracy in the timing to his departure.
Tom?
Jack, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and we just learned yesterday in Ann's paper that Petraeus is, in fact, not going to write the report himself. It's going to be written by the White House speechwriting department.
Is that settled? Is that a done deal? I know there was talk of it.
Well, I saw it in yesterday's Washington Post, and it was on the news last night. If you start looking at the statements of Republican senators during the last debate about the war, General Petraeus will tell us, we're waiting for General Petraeus. He will give us the word. He will tell us. Well, now we're going to find out it's going to be filtered through the White House talking shop.
Let's go to Leo in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Leo, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Pretty good.
Listen, I'm one of the quiet Americans that sit back and hope that our politicians can take care of all these problems that they're paid to do so.
It would be great.
All I hear is from both sides, Republicans, Democrats, and all these bleeding hearts out there, all they know how to do is blame everybody for everything and point fingers and criticize, but nobody comes up with a solution.
Where are you expecting to hear it from? Where are you putting your hope then, Leo?
I want this problem resolved. I want a definite plan of action. Say this is what we're going to do, and I want everybody to get together and work on it and stop blaming and criticizing.
Yeah, Leo, we understand that sentiment absolutely. Roy Seacoff, is Leo going to get relief? Do you see a persuasive new plan coming from the Bush administration? If not, do you see it coming from the Democratic Congress?
Well, yeah, absolutely not. I mean, I think that's why this was a major thing that happened this week. As Jack and Ann pointed out, for months now, the name Petraeus has been sprinkled with pixie dust. He was in fact become the Petraeus ex machina. You know, he was going to fly in on the Blackhawks.
Jack's and favorite give phrase, us, almost. Yeah.
Yes, and give us this great ending. And you know, and Bush cited him endlessly, 106 times, I believe. Ann's paper pointed out that he's been mentioned since January, but now suddenly. Suddenly, David, as the president has taken to calling him in press conferences, is not
that brings the general down a few stars. Calling
exactly
him Davy boy.
No, but that's how much he trusts him, though. Mm-hmm. He trusts him so much he's going to call him David. Mm-hmm. But not only that, David is not only going to not write it, but he's not even going to give the testimony in front of Congress publicly. Now they're saying it's going to be in private, right? Which is this White House's favorite thing. From the 9/11 testimony of Bush and Cheney, it had to be in private, no transcripts. Harriet Myers can come and talk to you, but private, no transcripts. And so this is the great arrival of Petraeus, which he's going to walk across the Potomac, it seems, walking across water, is now turning into this fizzle thing, because maybe even he won't say the things that they want the White House wants him to say.
And how do you read all this then to Leo's question? Are we on a steady as she roughly goes course? Is somebody going to change course? It doesn't seem that the Democrats are really going to change it from Congress. A strike on Iran would change things, but with Iraq itself, do you see the administration looking to kind of change up? Are they under pressure from Republicans politically to offer some kind of troop drawdown or withdrawal?
Well, they've been able to delay that question now all this time, again, as we're saying, because of the pending Petraeus report. I think at some point they're going to be under increasing pressure from Republicans who want to get reelected in the House and ones who are running for president next November to make something start to work. We've already seen what the war has done to John McCain, even for the other candidates who weren't ones voting for it and actively supporting it. It still remains hugely problematic because the Republican brand is still so tarnished by Iraq. But to the caller's real question about people getting along and not just being a number of Washington insiders battling each other, that's what's so interesting about the campaign trail right now. Mm. You hear both sides really starting to talk that way. This is the sort of the center of Barack Obama's candidacy, but even Hillary Clinton, who's been viewed as the big polarizing force, they're all talking about ratcheting down the tone, getting to Washington and actually changing everything. Every single event I go to, no matter whose it is, talks in those terms.
That is what to ratchet down the tension. Let's be level-headed and work things out.
Let's accomplish something. You know, you hear Mitt Romney. It's all about let's stop the bickering. Voters are tired of the fighting. Now, it's true that we've been hearing this for you know, a decade and a half. And even George Bush himself ran on a platform of being a uniter, not a divider. But now, 8 years after that, obviously didn't work. The candidates are, again, Democrats and Republicans talking about getting things done.
Rose out of town. Maybe there's an opening. Let's go to Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
I want to thank Jack Beatty for the comments he made concerning the Padilla trial. Very much on point. Not to you get the idea.
Yeah.
Anyways, if any week demonstrates this, the American voter should come to the realization that how they vote makes a difference. I mean, instead of asking candidates, for example, whether or not they believe in God, they should start asking their candidates whether or not they believe in their oath of office. As for the some of the latest disasters, like the mine disaster.
Yeah, heartbreaking.
Well, yes, it is. And having said that, you're talking about two states that I think two times in a row voted for this administration. This is an administration that loosened up the safety regulations, that ignored certain safety regulations, didn't fund inspectors and that sort of thing.
You're blaming the White House for what happened under a mountain in Utah? Excuse
me?
You're blaming the White House for what happened under a mountain in Utah?
I'm blaming the White House for this cavalier attitude about it's not government's place to enforce safety laws. Or this, you know, we shouldn't be bothered with this sort of thing. It's too much government intrusion, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Let us pick it up. Bill Roy Seacoff, this is out toward your neck of the woods. Of course, the mine owner has said, act of God. Scientists say something different. But now the whole thing called off with the rescuers killed. You know, Bill's pointing all the way back to Washington. Fair?
Yes, I think it is. And I think this is something that is, and I agree with the caller completely in the fact that the media have been focusing, of course they should be focusing on the rescue, but they haven't been focusing on the other part of it, the upstream issue. Why were these miners trapped in the first place? And I think particularly we see it with the owner, as you say, who keeps claiming that it was an earthquake when the seismologists say, no, that wasn't the fact. But he keeps being presented. He's on CNN 7, 8 times a day, and he comes across as the avuncular, caring boss, when in fact the truth is he's a major big energy player who has 19 mines that have racked up millions and millions of dollars in safety violations. And, you know, as the Salt Lake paper has found out, there was a memo back in March in this very same mine pointing out that there were dangerous conditions and they had to close down one section of it just 900 feet away using this kind of special retreat mining, they call
right,
it, where they
right.
dig out part of the pillars and it makes it more unsafe. So, yeah, I think it is fair not to just have him be presented as the heroic guy coming up with the coal-stained face saying, you know, pray for us.
Jack, I know you've been following the lines there.
Yeah, I mean, well, apropos Bill's point, I mean, the Huffington Post also reports a backgrounder on this mine safety czar, Richard Stickler, the man who's been beside Murray in these press conferences. He got a recess appointment from Bush last year because he couldn't be appointed by the Republican Senate. Arlen Specter was against him. Rick Santorum was disappointed that the White House had nominated him. Why? Because as a mine owner and someone connected with Pennsylvania mines, he had repeatedly been cited for unsafe practices and the like. And then his reaction to the West Virginia mine disaster was, you know, he wasn't going to insist on whatever the safety remedy was for that. So we've got this mine safety guy who's in the business, it seems to me, of sort of saying to big miners, hey, you don't worry about safety regulations.
News all over this week in Peru, a big quake.
It hit in the early evening, a massive earthquake that shook Peru for two terrifying minutes.
From China to the U.S., more toys recalled for safety threats.
Hello, I'm Bob Ecker, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Mattel. As a parent of four children myself, I know that absolutely nothing is more important than the safety and well-being of children.
And in Carson, California, soccer star David Beckham finally took the field.
Kenny Bendick. Beckham! It's in the net! It's in the net! Do you believe it? Beckham can bend it!
Okay, we believe it. The ankle's fixed. He's out there. We're looking at a week in the news with Ann Kornblut of The Washington Post, Roy Seacoff of The Huffington Post, and Jack Beatty. Let's go to Peter in Augusta, Georgia. Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, sir.
Hi.
Some comments to give you a little bit of background on myself. Construction engineer. I worked in the metro Atlanta area many years ago when the MARTA system was going in. That's a rapid transit authority.
Right.
Putting the subway systems in there, both above ground and below ground, up to 400 feet, tunneling underneath the high-rise buildings and so on.
So you've worked underground. Are you taking us to Utah, Peter?
Yes, I'm speaking in reference to Utah.
Mm-hmm.
The mining incident. And what I want to say, it might not be taken well, but
let's
is this. We've lost several more lives in the unbelievable efforts.
Yeah.
And I compliment everybody involved trying to save these miners. I think there comes a time that we all need to understand that this is a very risky business. The above-ground construction, any of these fields and trades, such as war, and I've been in that too.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that are involved in it are well abreast and aware that some may die along the way, and I've watched that happen. It's not pretty, but the reality of it is no more lives should be risked in this effort.
You mean the rescue mission should be wrapped up? It's too late.
I think it should be. In my opinion, with all condolences to the families and et cetera, I think it's time to put some crosses up on top of that mountain and just stop.
And you're ready to cut some slack to the owner. You say this is just risky business.
It is risky business, and yes, I am. I can tell the man is dedicated. He's spared no expense, okay, whatsoever, and he still won't stop, even to the point of losing some more people.
Peter, stick with us for a second. Roy Seacoff, how do you respond to Peter? He sees the soot on the face of Mr. Murray. He knows that mining is an inherently risky business, and he's ready to say sad, over, maybe couldn't be helped.
Well, I would say that he has two things. One, he has spared no expense after the fact, but they actually have spared quite a bit of expense before the fact in all sorts of areas, communication between the mines. They have not put in the latest things. But the other thing, he's also spared no expense in using his political muscle. He's given over $213,000 to Republican candidates over the last 10 years, as well as another $725,000 through PACs connected to his businesses. And this has gotten him access to people like Mitch McConnell and to Elaine Chao, who's the head of the Labor Department.
But surely he didn't do that so his mine could fall down.
No, he did it so that he could avoid penalties and he could avoid having to make these mines as safe as possible. I mean, you have to understand, this is a dangerous thing. 104,000 people have died in coal mining accidents over the last century. So there's no question that this is a dangerous thing. One of the things that has to raise is, though, why are we still using this antiquated method of energy and not putting our interest in non-fossil-based energy from sources.
And that question comes right back home. Everybody with an air conditioner on we use a lot of coal to crank up the power in this country. We've all got a kind of a piece in it. Peter, thanks for your call from Augusta. Let's go to Belmont, Massachusetts, and Seth. Seth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to just make a comment about my top news story of the week, which was the conviction of Jose Padilla.
Yes.
And the comment that I wanted to make is I'm to the point of frustration with the overall mainstream media on subjects like this. Unless I'm imagining things, and I don't think I am, it seems like at least leading up to this conviction and the trial and so forth, there was almost a sympathy for Padilla that was prevalent in the press. And even after the conviction, again, I've spoken to many people about this, so I know it's not just me. It also seems like there's more concern about this guy than, what he was planning to potentially do, doing everything in his power to get into some type of training to inflict, death and murder on whether it's people of another country or our country. And I just don't understand this sympathy for these type of people within the media.
Seth, we've got it. Let me ask you before I go to our panel. Do you read it as sympathy for Padilla personally or concern over the U.S. Constitution and what can be done with U.S. citizens? I mean, the dirty bomb charges are gone. They evaporated.
The point does not escape me, and it's not that I have not put thought into it, but I just feel as though, maybe there's just this line of reasoning out there that when the United States government picks somebody up on some type of charges of potential terrorist activities and so forth, it almost just seems like, you know, this line of thought that they just do it with no reasonable suspicion or probable cause. They just pick somebody up off the street and throw them in the prison, you know, in Guantanamo or something.
And
I think that's the wrong line of thinking. I think I'm confident that they would not pick somebody up off the street without some reason to do it.
Let's look at that. And thank you very much for your call, Seth. Ann Kornblut, when John Ashcroft announced Padilla's arrest in 2002, he said that there was an unfolding terrorist plot to attack the United States by exploding a radioactive dirty bomb, one that could have caused mass death and injury. Now, those charges went away, and yet, you know, Padilla was clearly, not all peace and love, perhaps. The jury certainly found not. Our caller, Seth, says he hears sympathy for Padilla in the media and doesn't like it.
I think you put your finger on it, which is that far from being sympathy for anybody who would commit a terrorist act in this country, I think that there's been since 2002 increasing skepticism of what the government says it's got in terms of going to war, evidence against suspects, and certainly set against the backdrop of Osama bin Laden still being out there. I think media skepticism in general, but especially toward the war on terror and the evidence that's part of it, has grown enormously. And I think that's what he's seeing in the coverage of the Padilla case, is increasing scrutiny, increasing doubtfulness. And at the end of the day, he was convicted. And as we'd said earlier, the system seemed to work. And I didn't see in any of the post-case coverage, you know, sympathy for him or a desire for him to have gotten off. But I do think the caller's right, that it's been held up to a higher standard than I think some other things have been over the course of the last 5 years.
Let's hear from Steve on Padilla. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that last caller. It's definitely people don't take it seriously. You were joking earlier about the zucchini code word. No one would be laughing if that really turned out to be a code for something serious like September 11th.
But what does it mean that those charges just kind of floated away when the scrutiny came on?
Because they probably didn't think they had a strong enough case. Who would have thought they could, people with box cutters could take down planes and kill all those people? That wouldn't have been taken seriously either.
Yeah, I hear that, but let me ask you, Steve, I mean, the idea of an American citizen without charge in the brig, solitary for 3 years, doesn't that strike you as weird?
No, it wasn't like he was a Boy Scout being picked up.
He's a citizen. We do have constitutional rights.
I know, but there was reasonable suspicion, just like that previous caller said.
So bring charges. Why no charges for so long?
Because in a time of war, it's not like trying a case. It's you're picking up these people who are not wearing uniforms. They're pretending to be citizens or civilians, and they're really a part of an army.
Yeah, I mean, this is right at the nub of it, isn't it, Roy? When you feel that threat, you want to do whatever it takes. On the other hand, there's the Constitution with its ancient claims on us.
Yeah, there's absolutely no question that there are very bad people out there who want to do very bad things to this country. And, you know, this is as you say, this is where it really splits. How do you balance these things? How do you, and this plays to what you were talking about with the spy satellites. You know, how far do we want to give up our freedom? You know, part of us will say, yes, of course, if you can use a satellite to find, you know, somebody trying to bring chemical weapons into the country, do it. But the question is oversight. Who is saying how far is enough? As Jack was pointing out, they basically tortured Padilla. They gave him LSD. You know, they deprived him of sleep. Yes, absolutely. They gave him LSD, they deprived him of sleep, all these things to break him. And the question is, at what point do we say it's not worth it? And I'm not saying that there aren't people out there. It's the same thing when you watch like a movie like The Bourne Ultimatum and you're like, oh my God, can they really do that? And if they can, how come we haven't gotten Osama bin Laden if they can use a satellite to see somebody's license plate? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So on the one hand, of course, I want everybody to do everything, but I'm not sure that these things wouldn't have been taken seriously before 9/11 by many people. They were were by the FBI agents in Arizona who were looking into these people who were taking flying lessons. It wasn't taken seriously, by the way, by the Bush administration, where they had the memo saying Bin Laden to attack, you know, wants to strike U.S. and that wasn't taken seriously.
Tom, you know, John McCain has been eloquent about this issue of torture. He's been tortured. He was tortured in Vietnam. He says it doesn't work, but the main thing he says is it isn't America. It isn't America. This isn't what we are. We're something better than this. And that's what I would say to the caller. That isn't America.
Well, let's get out on the campaign trail with Ann and see what she's hearing. A little sound here from Mitt Romney at the Iowa State Fair, not the only candidate there this week. Romney was cooking up pork chops in front of photographers and fairgoers. The former Massachusetts governor had a little grill accident.
There's a five-second rule.
Is there a five-second rule? Okay, five-second rule on the ground, huh? That's what we need. It's something warm here. Is this not warm enough? So we need to.
What's your favorite food?
Just had it. What was that?
What's your favorite food?
Well, I'm afraid to tell you, I love hot dogs and hamburgers, but I. There goes one.
There goes one. And the question is, what's your favorite food? Meanwhile, we got all this other stuff going on. I mean, how are the issues shaking down when you sit and talk with Iowa voters? What are they really focused on?
Well, it's it's true. There's a lot of frivolity out here in Iowa. It is August, after all.
It's fair time.
Part of what we're seeing the candidates do this month, before Labor Day in particular, is just come out here, show their human side, have some fun with people. Really important for especially Romney and Hillary Clinton to show that they're in touch and they can relate to people. But when they start working the rope line or they start taking questions, we've gotten a lot of questions on the Republican side this week. Rudy Giuliani was at the fair also a couple days ago. He, from Republican voters, got a lot of questions about illegal immigration and about national security. A lot of voters still identifying him exclusively with 9/11, coming up to him and saying, "We loved you on 9/11. You're our guy." And the support for him here is, I would say, stronger, or at least feels stronger than I would have expected, because it's Iowa. How much do they really know about Giuliani? On the Democratic side, still a lot of questions about the war, of course. But now that the Democrats all seem to have sort of settled into a position that is roughly equivalent, looking past their original votes, now focusing on getting out, you're starting to see additional questions about health care, about the economy, about workers, people feeling very uncertain right now about what their futures are going to be. So a lot more domestic issues. We'll I'm sure, get to hear these all aired out on Sunday. There's another Democratic debate here. I know it feels like a debate a day around now. But George Stephanopoulos is going to conduct another debate on Sunday morning, so we'll get to hear more of that.
Hillary Clinton rolling out a new ad as the primary race in Iowa heats up. Let's listen.
If you're a family that is struggling and you don't have health care, well, you are invisible to this president. If you're a single mom trying to find affordable child care so you can go to work, well, you're invisible too. And I never thought I would see that our soldiers who serve in Iraq and Afghanistan would be treated as though they were invisible as well.
Sounds like a Ken Burns documentary with the background music there. Let's go to Adam in Boston. Adam, you're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. Hi. I just wanted to comment on the last two callers. I think they kind of exemplify the portion of America that's just willing to sell the Constitution down the river because of the sense of threat out there. And not to minimize the threat, but, you know, if they can pick up a guy like Padilla, not charge him publicly, they can pick up any of us. And I think that a government that went to war for less than stellar reasons is more than willing to pick up people for trumped-up charges. And I think that's been proven, in a number of cities already, where people have been picked up, held without trial or lawyer, and then released because, in fact, there was no case. And those folks were lucky enough to actually get released.
Yeah, but Adam, a jury of Padilla's peers has now found him guilty. Terrorism conspiracy charges. Guilty. Miami.
Great. Then he should have gone to trial 3 years ago. He should have gone to trial when he was arrested. You know, if he's guilty, great, send him to jail, punish him accordingly. But treat him like an American citizen. Give him due process. The fact that these rights can be so stripped away and that Americans are so willing to go along with that is horrifying to me. I just think about Mussolini. I think about all these very, kind of corporate governments out there that are that get support from the people because they promise security, and in exchange for that security, they strip away rights, and here we are, it's happening right in front of us.
Adam, thanks for your call. Anne, do you think this is going to be at the heart of the debate as we get into the home stretch for the general election? Is it going to be about security and constitutional rights? You know, you've written that what if 2000 was the Seinfeld election, about nothing in a way. This election's about everything, big stuff on the table. Will that be at the heart of it?
Well, certainly over the last few weeks, it seemed to be. Barack Obama is a constitutional lawyer and talks about these issues a lot on the campaign trail. Giuliani, this is a relentless theme of his, is getting the bad guys. I mean, he uses phrases like that and talks
kind
about
kind of whatever it takes idea.
Throwing out, you know, let's throw foreigners out if they commit a crime. So I think, and certainly Hillary Clinton too, so protecting individual rights. I mean, there is no question in my mind this is part of the emerging dialogue between these two sides, and no matter who the nominee is on either side, it certainly will be going forward.
Well, with that, we're out of time. Anne Kornblut in Des Moines, Iowa, with us today. Anne, thanks for your eye on all the news. Always good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Anne Kornblut with the Washington Post, and Roy Seacoff at the Huffington Post joining us today from Culver City, California. Stay cool. Come back, Roy. Thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure, Tom.
Jack Beatty, not a regular August here. Too much hopping.
Yeah, of course, above ground, underground, in space, you've got
it. Wow, let's get to the beach or somewhere. But Jack, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.